A very, very big thank you to the Arts Council England. Without this, it wouldn't be possible. So thank you to them. And I have great pleasure in introducing Daniel Kane, who's going to be talking to you about the wonderful Frank O'Hara. And Daniel is a reader in American literature in the Department of English at the University of Sussex. His books include All Poets Welcome, the Lower East Side Poetry Scene in the 1960s, and the book We Saw the Light, Conversations Between the New American Cinema and Poetry. And his recently completed monograph, Kill the Bastards, The New York School, is forthcoming with Columbia University Press in spring 2017. Welcome, Daniel.
Thank you, and thank you so much for this really generous invitation, and to be in this absolutely charming space is a real treat for me. This is, in a sense, going to be a sort of greatest hits of Frank O'Hara talk. I hope that's okay, and I hope for those of you who are familiar with Frank O'Hara's greatest hits that you might learn something new or get a different kind of perspective on those hits, and that for those of you who aren't aware of Frank O'Hara necessarily, I hope that this talk will at least encourage you to read his truly delightful poetry. A bit of background on O'Hara. He's a core member of what is called the New York School, the New York School of Poetry. And in terms of a basic background, who is in the New York School, there's a group of writers who met in the 1940s at Harvard University. It includes Frank O'Hara, Kenneth Koch, John Ashbery, and then those three core members move to New York and meet up with other poets, including James Schuyler and Barbara Guest. It's important to get a sense of how, in a sense, unusual they were in terms of their tastes, where they were coming from. Their influences were not so much the grandees of modernism, as they were French surrealist poets, Dada artists, and especially in terms of their own contemporaries, the abstract expressionist painters. And it's this connection with the painters that's really crucial to getting a sense of the poet's contribution to American verse following World War II. All the poets that I mentioned hung out with the painters. I'm talking about people like Willem de Kooning, Jackson Pollock, Mark Rothko, etc. Crucially, and I hope I get to make this point as the talk progresses, the poets also had a special affection for representational painters, that is, painters who actually painted something you could recognize on the canvas. And these were painters including figures like Larry Rivers, Jane Fraelker, and Michael Goldberg, some of whom will appear in the poems I'll read for you today. Just to give you a sense of the environment in the late 40s, early 50s, when the poets moved to New York, a truly exciting time in the history of avant-garde art. This is John Ashbery reminiscing about this period. My arrival in New York coincided with the cresting of the heroic period of abstract expressionism. Now, I want you all to remember that word heroic because it's going to be a word I sort of pick apart as the talk progresses. I'll start again. My arrival in New York coincided with the cresting of the heroic period of abstract expressionism, as it was later to be known. And somehow we all seemed to benefit from this strong moment, even if we paid little attention to it and seemed to be going our separate ways. We were in awe of de Kooning, Pollock, Rothko, and Robert Motherwell, and not too sure of exactly what they were doing. The name the New York School then is bestowed on them by a gallery curator named John Bernard Myers, who was main curator at a gallery called Tibor Denage on West 57th Street, which is still actually still there, still running, and still committed to showing first, second, third, fourth, et cetera, generation New York School painters. It's on 57th Street. One of the things that attracts me to O'Hara's work is the sense of the poem as a kind of social occasion. And you'll see that, looking back on the work, that a lot of these poets were committed to poetry as a collaborative act, and I'm speaking literally, materially. John writes a line, then Frank writes the next one. Kenneth will kick in another line. You never know who wrote which one. The poem gets published. So these poets were also actually posing a challenge as to what constitutes authorship, right? And that's an interesting and sweetly dissident move, I think. And hopefully there'll be... Actually, will there be time for questions and answers? Okay, good. So hopefully we'll be able to build a little bit on that question. I should add that all these poets also wrote for Art News, one of the main art journals at the period of the period. Frank O'Hara similarly reminisces, and this is Frank. "We were all in our early 20s. John Ashbery, Barbara Guest, Kenneth Koch, and I, being poets, divided our time between the literary bar, the San Remo, and the artist bar, the Cedar Tavern. In the San Remo, we argued and gossiped. In the Cedar, we often wrote poems while listening to the painters argue and gossip. So far as I know, nobody painted in the San Remo while they listened to the writers argue and gossip." You can already tell that O'Hara is a little bit cheeky, right? And for me, one of the greatest things O'Hara wrote was not necessarily something you might call a poem, but is his pseudo-manifesto personism. I say pseudo-manifesto with some measure of reticence because I actually think it's a really serious document, despite the fact that with an initial reading it appears to be somewhat ridiculous. Did they get copies? Oh, great. So you have copies of it. So you can read along if you wish. I'm going to read some of the opening paragraphs from Personism. But before I do so, I'd like to ask you to ask yourselves, you know, is this kind of document useful in articulating a poetics? Or does O'Hara's chattiness, in a sense, dissuade us as readers from taking this kind of work too seriously? I'm interested in O'Hara as someone who chats, someone who's really dedicated to conversation, chattiness, gossip, as we mentioned earlier. And I'm interested in chattiness as, in a sense, a mode that really undermines the authority of poetic measure, poetic seriousness. I would like to remind those of you who may not know that American poetry, particularly in the mid-50s, was a really riven affair. There was actually a clearly defined underground, right? The underground poets, the avant-garde poets, and a clearly defined mainstream. I'm saying this because I don't think there's such a clear binary now. I mean, Sarah Jane will attest to this. I work at the University of Sussex, where there's, I think it's fair to say, a world-renowned poet named Keston Sutherland, who is quite literally dedicated to Marxism, the revolution. This would be unheard of to have someone say, "I believe in socializing everything and smashing the state, etc., and here's your tenure document," right? Anyway, so there's a real divide here, and O'Hara's personism is, in a sense, a kind of engagement, an interrogation of that divide. This is Personism, the opening lines. "I don't even like rhythm, assonance, all that stuff. You just go on your nerve. If someone's chasing you down the street with a knife, you just run. You don't turn around and shout, 'Give it up, I was a track star for Mineola Prep.' Nobody should experience anything they don't need to. If they don't need poetry, bully for them. I like the movies too. And after all, only Whitman and Crane and Williams of the Americans are better than the movies. As for measure and other technical apparatus, that's just common sense. If you're going to buy a pair of pants, you want them to be tight enough so everyone will want to go to bed with you. There's nothing metaphysical about it." Oh, by the way, I should point out the pants in the United States are what you folks would call trousers, right? So I get there's a crucial distinction. I also want to point out that Personism, as much as it's invested in contesting the so-called mainstream or the so-called academic side of poetry, and by that I'm referring to poets that I'm sure many of you know, early Auden, Robert Lowell before Life Studies, W.D. Snodgrass, Alan Tate, John Crow Ransom. O'Hara wasn't just making fun of those guys, because it's very easy to, in a sense, dismiss some of those writers as stuffed shirts, and I would never make that far too easy mistake. O'Hara was also interested in contesting the self-importance attendant to the avant-garde. And Personism is a really direct riposte, I think, to another crucial manifesto of the American avant-garde, one that was written by a poet named Charles Olson. Maybe some of you are familiar with Charles Olson, who wrote an incredibly influential essay in 1950 called Projective Verse. And this essay was published in an anthology called The New American Poetry. This is an anthology that was published in 1960. It featured an image of the American flag and really was very clear about the book as a collection of groundbreaking avant-garde writers, with Charles Olson as a kind of big daddy of the new American avant-garde. And Projective Verse was something that was taken very seriously indeed as a document manifesto that, in a sense, defined how to go about articulating a model for free verse. Okay? Are you all following me, by the way? Yeah? Okay. And the thing about Olson's essay, Projective Verse, was that it was invested in this notion of the line. How do you define a line? How do you write a line of poetry if you don't have, in a sense, the stricture or straitjacket of meter to determine the form? And Olson's answer to that was the breath. Okay, so the poet actually pays very clear attention to his, and it was always his with Charles. The poet pays very careful attention to the measure of his natural breath, the rhythms of his breath. This is, I'm now going to read a little excerpt from Olson's Projective Verse. The line comes, I swear it, from the breath, from the breathing of the man who writes at the moment that he writes, and thus is. It is here that the daily work, the work, gets in, for only he, the man who writes, can declare at every moment the line, its metric, and its ending, where its breathing shall come to termination. So even the lines themselves are, in a sense, an embodiment of the idea. The breath builds to a great, almost orgasmic crescendo, and then the release, termination. That's, whoa, you know, Jesus. And Olson was really, in a sense, there's a funny little paradox here, because for Olson, the great gift of the postmodern was, in a sense, the gift of the typewriter. Because for Olson, the typewriter, and I'm going to quote Olson again, with the typewriter, the poet could now, quote, indicate exactly the breath, the pauses, the suspensions, even of syllables, the juxtapositions, even of parts of phrases, which he intends. Maybe some of you are familiar with the poet Robert Creeley, who was a great follower, a friend of Olson's, and some of Creeley's shorter poems. So there's a very famous poem of Creeley's called I Know a Man, and on the line it simply goes, I know a man, as I said to my friend, for I am always talking. John, I said, which was not his name. You hear those line breaks as I'm performing them, albeit in a somewhat, perhaps over-determined way. Creeley got those line breaks from Olson's idea of the breath, and Creeley was a natural stutterer, right? So for Creeley, Olson was really important because it actually gave him a form to think about stuttering as a way of building a line. So the influence of Olson can't be underestimated in terms of the new American poetry. Now, going back to personism, again, O'Hara was very committed to making fun of practically everything. And O'Hara, I think, also was using personism as a challenge to, a friendly sort of frenemy-style challenge to Allen Ginsberg. We've all heard of Howl, I imagine, right? I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, right? So consider Ginsberg's Notes for Howl and other poems, which was included in the New American Poetry anthology that I was referring to earlier. In Ginsberg's Notes to Howl, Ginsberg claims that he had written the poem, and I'm quoting, for my own soul's ear and a few other golden ears, that it involves long saxophone-like chorus lines I knew Kerouac would hear the sound of. So again, I have written the poem for my own soul's ear and a few other golden ears, long saxophone-like chorus lines I knew Kerouac would hear the sound of. I'm interested in reading personism alongside those kinds of claims as well, because I see personism as aimed squarely at what might be considered to be a fairly inflated rhetoric employed by poets like Ginsberg, particularly when that rhetoric is used to puff up the authority of the bard, right? To in a sense, promote this vision of the poet as prophet. What do I mean by that? Take Ginsberg's 1948 Blake vision. And this is a vision Blake had when he was a fairly young guy living up in Harlem, and he was looking out of his window reading Ah, Sunflower, and he suddenly heard Blake speaking to him from a sign across the street. Blake vision. And Ginsberg claimed he, and I'm quoting again, I heard Blake's voice pronounce Ah, Sunflower and the sick rose and experienced an illumination of eternal consciousness. my own heart identical with the ancient heart of the universe. So again, this tale by 1965 is practically a legend passed around reverentially by beat enamored readers, and one that Ginsberg referred to repeatedly throughout his career to distinguish himself as special, chosen, touched. I would really urge those of you who are not familiar with the Blake vision to read an incredible interview with a poet named Tom Clark, published in 1965 on the Paris Review, which you can get online. And Ginsberg goes into great detail about this particular moment in his life. So we're getting a sense here, I hope, of Ginsberg's poetics as interiorized, vatic, visionary. And personism, to me, is such a strange alternative to that. O'Hara's poetics are casual, social, and crucially, conversational. When was personism founded? O'Hara asks rhetorically, and I'm quoting O'Hara. It was founded by me after lunch with Leroy Jones. I was realizing while writing a poem for someone that if I wanted to, I could use the telephone instead of writing the poem. Later on in the Personism Manifesto, O'Hara writes that personism, and I quote, puts the poem squarely between the poet and the person, Lucky Pierre style. This is very outrageous. Lucky Pierre refers to the lucky person in the middle of a so-called three-way, right? So the poem becomes this person who's getting cuddled on both ends. Again, a very strange and fairly naughty way of conceiving of a new American poetics. As O'Hara put it, quote, the poem is at last between two persons. Instead of two pages. So there's, again, that conversational and even sensual dynamic that O'Hara proposes his poems are invoking. So O'Hara's personism is certainly a riposte to academic writers at the time, as well as avant-garde writers. I would point those of you in the audience to these so-called academic or anthology, one New Poets of England and America. Now, this anthology was often invoked as the safe milquetoast anthology in comparison to the daring avant-garde anthology, New American Poetry. And no anthology of contemporary poetry published since World War II has been as much vilified as New Poets of England and America, especially as it's regularly contrasted again with Allen's The New American Poetry. New Poets of England and America has been made to seem representative of poetic values characteristic of mainstream or academic poetry of the 1950s. So again, a kind of poetry, it is said, that timidly retreated from the ambitions of modernist poetry. So poets like Donald Hall, Robert Pack, Louise Simpson, and I'm not saying, you know, they're bad, but they were, in a sense, moving away from the great modernist experiments of Joyce, particularly Joyce, Stein, Pound. Okay, it's as if those great experiments in writing had, in a sense, never occurred. So it was a return back to the possibilities of English metaphysical poetry, of all things. Again, I would like to illustrate this by saying, imagine a world where there is an Eliot without a Pound, okay? Auden's urbanity without the politics and the sensuality. What Clarence Brooks refers to as the well-wrought urn, and maybe some of us have heard this term to describe the perfect lyric poem, the well-wrought urn. Okay, so now imagine, and I'm hoping I'm providing a sort of general context for the underground and mainstreams of poetry in the late 50s, what a poem like Blocks must have sounded like, Frank O'Hara's Blocks. And do you have the opening lines available to you? No. Oh, great. I'll just read the first stanza. Blocks. Yippee! She is shooting in the harbor. He is jumping up to the maelstrom. She is leaning over the giant's cart of tears, which like a lava cone let fall to fly from the cross-eyed, tantrum-tousled ninth grader's splayed fist, is freezing on the cement. He is throwing up his arms in heavenly desperation, spacious why of his tumultuous love nerves flailing like a poinsettia in its own nailish storm against the glass door of the cumulus, which is withholding her from these divine pastures she has filled with the flesh of men as stones. Oh, fatal eagerness. So this poem is clearly not, you know, what we might call emotions recollected in tranquility, right? This is a poem more akin to a kind of improvisatory event. This poem seems to be happening as we're reading it and seems to move along associatively, improvisatorially, propelled by what the scholar Hazel Smith describes, I think, terrifically as, quote, the sheer exclamatory exuberance of the opening. So a poem like Blocks is not by any means a representation of reality, but the enactment by the artist of certain attitudes and choices within that reality. And the implications of a poem like this, I think, are quite profound. That is, there are no necessary canonical or privileged subjects for poetry. As the poet Paul Carroll put it, anything literally can exist in a poem, and anything can exist in whatever way the poet chooses. So O'Hara is, in a sense, providing us with an example of how there are poets in this room, right? I mean, so this is a poem, in a sense, that proposes two writers that one need no longer feel committed to organic unity as a principle of poetic construction. Details don't need to be chosen to illustrate a specific lyric point or attitude. It's a kind of anti-organicist aesthetic, what Carroll defines as the impure poem. I think it's a terrific term which can be applied to practically all the poems that I'll consider today. Of course, not all of O'Hara's poems were this resistant to paraphrase, this wacky, for lack of a better word. And certainly not all of O'Hara's poems were that resistant to recognizable poetic genres and forms. And I mean it quite seriously when I say that I think Frank O'Hara is perhaps one of the preeminent post-war elegists, American elegists, albeit an elegy that is beautifully understated and leavened often with a sort of caustic humor and delicious wit. Is a step away from them on your handout there? If not, it's... Oh, great. Let me just get to that myself. I'll read the whole thing. A step away from them. Oh, by the way, O'Hara referred to these types of poems that were collected in his volume Lunch Poems as my I do this, I do that poems. I do this, I do that poems. A step away from them. It's my lunch hour, so I go for a walk among the hum... It's my lunch hour, so I go for a walk among the hum-colored cabs. First down the sidewalk where laborers feed their dirty, glistening torsos sandwiches and Coca-Cola with yellow helmets on. They protect them from falling bricks, I guess. Then onto the avenue where skirts are flipping above heels and blow up over grates. The sun is hot, but the cabs stir up the air. I look at bargains and wristwatches. There are cats playing in sawdust. On to Times Square where the sign blows smoke over my head, and higher, the waterfall pours lightly. A Negro stands in a doorway with a toothpick, languorously agitating. A blonde chorus girl clicks. He smiles and rubs his chin. Everything suddenly honks. It is 12:40 of a Thursday. Sorry, I love that line. Neon in daylight is a great pleasure, as Edwin Denby would write, as are light bulbs in daylight. I stop for a cheeseburger at Juliet's Corner. Giulietta Messina, wife of Federico Fellini, a bella trice, and chocolate malted. A lady in foxes on such a day puts her poodle in a cab. There are several Puerto Ricans on the avenue today, which makes it beautiful and warm. First Bunny died, then John Latouche, then Jackson Pollock. But is the earth as full as life was full of them? And one has eaten and one walks past the magazines with nudes and the posters for Bullfight and the Manhattan Storage Warehouse, which they'll soon tear down. I used to think they had the Armory show there. A glass of papaya juice and back to work. My heart is in my pocket. It is poems by Pierre Rivardi. Did you detect those strange moment of I ams, but is the earth as full as life was full of them? It's such this wonderful musical moment in the midst of an otherwise fairly chatty narrative text, a classic instance of O'Hara's I do this, I do that, i.e. first, then, I look, onto, etc. And that wonderful specificity of 12:40, right? It is 12:40, looking at the watch. So again, the poem is a kind of social occasion, the conversational dynamic of O'Hara's poetry, really straining through at those particular moments. There's something that probably many of you recognize here, that sense of the campy flaneur, right? The walker walker of the city, who lets his attention be, in a sense, determined by the accidental glimpse of flash of a sign, that moment where the skirt flies up over the grates. By the way, that waterfall that he's referring to, that's an artificial waterfall that used to be in the center of Times Square. It's a part of a cigarette advertisement, so you'd see this fake water. So everything's fake, false surface, but also it seems, including, by the way, the Puerto Ricans, who O'Hara, very problematically, I would say, aestheticizes. Oh, look, there's some Puerto Ricans. They add a little bit of color to the day, don't they? Make it feel even more warm than it otherwise would. So there's a kind of implicit homoeroticism in this poem that is very curious. You find, following Walt Whitman especially, that a certain aspect of working class life is highly sexualized. And again, akin to Whitman's great Leaves of Grass, one senses New York as a kind of stage for the great democratic panorama, the possibilities of American demos, which O'Hara celebrates. And again, he celebrates it so iconoclastically. Look, ladies are putting poodles in a cab. Right? What a charming detail to identify and isolate and to draw our attention to. I would also add that O'Hara is using names here really, really curiously. First, Bunny died. Does anyone know who Bunny is? Does it matter if we don't know who Bunny is? Isn't it wonderful that O'Hara is creating such a apparently accessible text that we're invited to participate in a social world where we're rubbing shoulders with Jackson, where we're moving along with John, where we can imagine our own Bunny, etc. This is an inherently friendly poem. But again, what makes this poem more than just a sort of charming time capsule of 1950s New York is that it's also, I think, a really moving elegy, right? It's a poem of sorrow. It's a poem dedicated to remembering my friends who died. First, Bunny died, then John Latouche, then Jackson Pollock, and then comes the music of those I ams. But is the earth as full as life was full of them? Very unusual moment for O'Hara, and his ear is pitched so critically, I think, and beautifully to that extremely subtle moment of elegy. There's an element, I think, here in O'Hara's work, and especially his elegiac poetry, there's an element here of healthy embarrassment. He doesn't want you to see him cry, but he also is determined to make sure you know that he feels this great wellspring of sorrow. And you'll see the same kinds of moves in O'Hara's extremely famous poem, The Day Lady Died. All these details are layered on to the poem only to then make way for that moment of elegy. And you realize that what had preceded those moments of elegy was O'Hara pushing away feeling, right? Let's just try and figure out a way not to be sad. Let's see what can delight me. I can't take it anymore. Here's my sorrow. Here's the moment. And there's the intimation of that, I think, is enacted most wonderfully in that line, everything suddenly honks. It is 12:40 of a Thursday. It is, in a funny sort of way, a ridiculously romantic moment, right? It's that moment of transcendence where O'Hara takes on precisely that shamanic persona that personism purports to reject. You follow me? It's Prospero. But it's in New York, and it's frank, and it's fun. but it's still that great romantic Vedic moment. We still have time, so if we could just quickly turn to The Day Lady Died. Are people aware of who the lady is? Yeah. Billie Holiday, right? So she was referred to as Lady Day. Those wonderful, the Good Morning Heartache, Lover Man. Good, okay, we know the songs. The Day Lady Died. Again with the time. It is 12:20 in New York, a Friday, 3 days after Bastille Day. Yes, it is 1959, and I go get a shoe shine because I will get off the 419 in East Hampton at 7:15 and then go straight to dinner, and I don't know the people who will feed me. I walk up the muggy street beginning to sun and have a hamburger and a malted and buy an ugly New World writing to see what the poets in Ghana are doing these days. I go onto the bank and Miss Stillwagon, first name Linda I once heard, doesn't even look up my balance for once in her life. And in the Golden Griffin, I get a little Verlaine for Patsy with drawings by Bernard, although I do think of Hesiod, Transitive Richmond Lattimore, or Brendan Behan's new play, or Le Balcon, or Le Nègre of Genet, but I don't. I stick with Verlaine after practically going to sleep with quandariness. And for Mike, I just stroll into the Park Lane liquor store and ask for a bottle of Strega. And then I go back where I came from to Sixth Avenue and the tobacconist in the Ziegfeld Theater and casually ask for a carton of Galois and a carton of Picayune and a New York Post with her face on it. And I am sweating a lot by now and thinking of leaning on the John door and the five spot while she whispered a song along the keyboard to Mal Waldron, and everyone and I stopped breathing. So again, those details are layered on. We're seduced as readers and become, perhaps not all of us, but maybe some of us, become enamored with the absolutely delightful cosmopolitanism of O'Hara's New York, only to come to that final stanza and realize that this is a poem about repressing that sorrow, figuring out a way to keep it at bay until one can't, in a sense, control it anymore, ending with that moment again where, in a funny sort of way, everyone is, everything suddenly honks. There is that moment of transcendence where that very strange use of pronouns comes into play, and everyone and I stopped breathing. It's very hard to figure out who the speaker is at that point, who the subject is, who's being addressed. An incredibly ambiguous final line. And again, I'm wondering how effective this poem would have been had O'Hara preceded it, in a sense, traditionally, preceding it with emotional tributes. That's sort of the props customary to most traditional elegies. In another sense, The Day Lady Died isn't about Billie Holiday at all, and I'm going to quote Paul Carroll. It is about the common but sobering feeling that life continues on its humbling way despite the tragic death of an important artist or some loved one. Okay. Mike is a painter named Mike Goldberg, a really close friend of O'Hara's, and again, a subject that appears consistently throughout O'Hara's work and makes perhaps the most famous appearance in the poem Why I Am Not a Painter. And I'll start to conclude by just turning to this poem. Is this on your... Great. Okay, Why I Am Not a Painter. I am not a painter, I am a poet. Why? I think I would rather be a painter, but I am not. Well, for instance, Mike Goldberg is starting a painting. I drop in. Sit down and have a drink, he says. I drink, we drink. I look up. You have sardines in it. Yes, it needed something there. Oh. I go, and the days go by, and I drop in again. The painting is going on, and I go, and the days go by. I drop in. The painting is finished. Where's sardines? All that's left is just letters. It was too much, Mike says. But me, one day I am thinking... Sorry, this is very funny. But me, one day I am thinking of a color, orange. I write a line about orange. Pretty soon it is a whole page of words, not lines. Then another page. There should be so much more, not of orange, of words, of how terrible orange is and life. Days go by. It is even in prose. I am a real poet. My poem is finished, and I haven't mentioned orange yet. It's 12 poems. I call it Oranges. And one day in a gallery, I see Mike's painting called Sardines. I'm always delighted by this, poem as a kind of reflection of the creative process, this comparison of the writing of O'Hara's poem, Oranges, with the painting of Sardines, this canvas by O'Hara's great friend, the painter Mike Goldberg. So we can see that this poem is told in the first person from O'Hara's point of view. It's a fairly straightforward narrative poem. O'Hara drops in as Goldberg is starting his painting. After describing the process Goldberg goes through in order to complete Sardines, O'Hara reflects upon the process he himself goes through in order to write Oranges. Now, both of these artworks have what appear to be fairly unusual starting points. O'Hara is initiating the poetic process by thinking about the color orange, and then Goldberg begins his painting by brushing that word sardines on his canvas. But in the end, as we already know, neither of the finished works contain a trace of what originally inspired them. O'Hara's poem, it seems, never even mentions the word oranges, and Goldberg's painting no longer has the word sardines in it. And during the course of this poem, O'Hara doesn't mention the title of either the poem or the painting he is discussing until the end. So I wonder if we're beginning to see a pattern here, right? Like with a step away from them, that mention of Bunny, Jackson, John. With Day Lady Died, she comes in at the very end. And similarly, in this poem, the purported subjects finally make their appearance at the end. And O'Hara reveals that despite the disappearance within each work of the original source of inspiration, the finished poem and painting are titled still, respectively, Oranges and Sardines. I'm really interested, again, as I said earlier, about this poem as an enactment of process. This poem as something that is not recollecting, but again, as similar to Bloch's, albeit far more clear, narratively speaking. The poem seems to, in a sense, make a virtue out of not knowing anything. The poem seems to be making a virtue out of having an idea and then just allowing the idea to go away in favor of the process determining the content and form of the artwork. So again, the author, in a sense, as director of poem or painting, seems to fall back. And what takes place in its stead is this mysterious thing called process. Let's make the poem reveal the fact that we actually don't really know what we're doing. This poem always reminds me, just a little bit of an anecdote. I once had the great fortune of interviewing the poet John Ashbery, okay? And it was for a book on teaching creative writing, okay? And maybe some of you have taken classes in creative writing, like creative writing poetry, and then there's a sort of cliche, but it's true, and as most cliches are, where a creative writing instructor at one point in your life will say to you, when you say to him or her, what am I supposed to write about? That creative writing instructor will say, write what you know. Have you, you've heard that one? I've heard that, you know, I love this. Write what you know. So I remember saying to Ashbery, you know, you as a great American poet, what do you make of this imperative to write what you know? And it was the only time where I've ever seen Ashbery flustered. He literally turned red in the face and sort of harumphed, as you might say, and said, but we don't know anything. We don't know anything. And that, in a sense, opened the door for me. It's become sort of a mantra, albeit a very self-serving one in many cases. What might it be like to base a poetics? What might it be like to think about a process when one acknowledges that one is living in doubt, irresolution, one has no real idea of what one's doing, one may think one is going to paint a painting about sardines, but suddenly the painting takes over. What happens when one, in a sense, dedicates one's art to allowing that energy to occur and to let one's personality, in a sense, or will recede? I hope that makes some sense. I'm going to go to critic Marjorie Perloff, who I think is quite astute in thinking about why am I not a painter. And she describes this poem as, quote, a profound jest. And she points out that O'Hara, of course, was not himself a painter, despite the fact that he was heavily involved with the art world, and he would eventually become a curator at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. When asked by a critic at the time, a guy named Edward Lucy Smith, whether O'Hara had ever wanted to be a painter, O'Hara replied that he had not, although he admitted to fooling around with painting whenever he happened to be waiting around a studio for someone. And this is O'Hara. I might do some little thing, you know, but I never really did it seriously because it seems to me that painting and sculpture takes so much concentration over such a period of time that I'm not sure I can do it, whereas one can write relatively fast. Speed, spontaneity, immediacy, everything suddenly honks. What time is it? It is 12. You get the connections, right? One can write relatively fast. Why? There's so many things to do. Why chip away at a piece of marble? You could just write a poem even while you're at a party. Just get it, you know, get it done. We should probably take O'Hara's statement with this proverbial tongue-in-cheek, though it is interesting, nevertheless, to consider that O'Hara did write Why I'm Not a Painter in response to Lucy Smith's question, were you ever a painter? We might also consider this poem, Why I'm Not a Painter, and related works of O'Hara's, alongside what a scholar named Daniel Belgrad has called the culture of spontaneity. Okay, the culture of spontaneity. And Belgrad insists, while perhaps arguably denying O'Hara the kind of political charge he accords to writers like Allen Ginsberg, Gregory Corso, Belgrad writes, the poetry of the first generation New York school poets was spontaneous and subjective. So Belgrad argues that this avant-garde promoted ideals of communal spontaneity, nowness, as part of a dissident stance. So there is a kind of politics here, as part of a dissident stance directed against a loathed academic scene and related conservative rationalism. Again, Belgrad. The culture of spontaneity developed an oppositional version of humanism, rooted in an alternative metaphysics embodied in artistic forms. The basic attributes of this alternative metaphysics can be summarized as intersubjectivity, again, that the lucky pair, in other words, lucky pair, intersubjectivity between two people, and body-mind holism. Spontaneity poses intersubjectivity in which reality is understood to emerge within a conversational dynamic. Things don't happen before you start talking. What I'm really interested in here is the way in which O'Hara makes the artistic process itself seem casual, conversational, stemming from a social occasion rather than a dark night of the soul. And again, this is a really far cry from what pop-affiliated artist James Rosenquist described as that sort of Jackson Pollock-dominated Sturm und Drang of the abstract expressionists. This brings me back to my opening comments about personism. Poetry, O'Hara seems to propose, is something you can do casually, even if that doesn't preclude poetry, of course, from being important. And I'll end by reading his poem, Lana Turner Has Collapsed, which O'Hara wrote on the hoof while taking a ferry from Manhattan to Staten Island to give a reading alongside Robert Lowell. Okay, just a little bit of background on this poem. Are some of you familiar with Robert Lowell? So Robert Lowell is considered to be the great poet affiliated with New Criticism prior to his publication of his book Life Studies, which marks his break from formalist verse into free verse. Interestingly enough, Lowell's Life Studies, he credited his break because he states that he read Ginsberg's Howl and it finally encouraged him to break out of what he described as his Boston Brahmin straitjacket. But at the time that Lana Turner, the poem Lana Turner was written, Robert Lowell was very much considered to be what might rudely be termed the stuffed shirt of American poetry. And O'Hara had publicly dismissed Lowell, claiming that he was far too, in a sense, self-involved to be taken seriously. Anyway, so O'Hara takes the ferry. Maybe some of you have been in Manhattan. You take that ferry from Lower Manhattan to Staten Island. And along the way, the legend goes, O'Hara learned that the great actress Lana Turner had collapsed, and he just penned a quick little poem, which he then read at the reading. This is quite funny. This is O'Hara on Robert Lowell, talking about Robert Lowell. I think Lowell has a confessional manner, which lets him get away with things that are really just plain bad. But you're supposed to be interested because he's supposed to be so upset. You know, that's just such a... One can learn so much from that. You know, it's like O'Hara particularly hated that poem, Skunk Hour, where Lowell is spying on... Yeah. And it's like, well, who cares? He's a peeping Tom. This really gives me the creeps. Like, that was O'Hara's take on Lowell. Anyway, I could go on and on about that. So O'Hara, who read prior to Lowell, introduced the reading by saying, and I'm quoting O'Hara, "On the ferry coming over here, I wrote a poem." And then he wrote he read the poem, "Lana Turner Has Collapsed," much to the amusement of the audience. I should say that when it was Lowell's turn to go to the podium, he said something to the effect of, after looking at O'Hara, you know, like that, he said, "Well, I'm sorry I didn't write a poem on the way over here." You know, the implication being that poetry is really serious and you shouldn't trivialize it by saying, like, "Oh, look, I just wrote a poem on the way over here." Lowell seemingly thinking that O'Hara is trivializing verse and camping it up. Anyway, enough of that. The poem, "Lana Turner Has Collapsed." "Lana Turner has collapsed. I was trotting along and suddenly it started raining and snowing. And you said it was hailing, but hailing hits you on the head hard. So it was really snowing and raining. And I was in such a hurry to meet you, but the traffic was acting exactly like the sky. And suddenly I see a headline, 'Lana Turner has collapsed.' There is no snow in Hollywood. There is no rain in California. I have been to lots of parties and acted perfectly disgraceful, but I never actually collapsed. Oh, Lana Turner, we love you. Get up." Terrific. So this is what I guess we might safely say is a sort of calculated flippancy. O'Hara is privileging spontaneity and improvisation over the more studied formal approaches taken by Lowell up to life studies, and is offering a new model, very new model at the time, for those readers suspicious both of the shamanic roles taken on by Beat Generation poets and that sort of metric-heavy formalism we might associate with some of the work of Robert Lowell, W.D. Snodgrass, and related poets blessed by the New Critics of the 1950s and collected in such anthologies as New Poets of England and America. O'Hara taught, if indirectly, that to young readers that they didn't have to aspire to the role of prophet if they were going in for the poetry bag. That mass culture, the movies, was just as relevant and enjoyable, if not, let's face it, often more enjoyable than most poetry, and that poetry itself could be written on the hoof at parties and for friends. But I also hope that I've shown that even those "I do this, I do that" poems of O'Hara are still able, miraculously, to be desperately sad. I'll end there, and there's a couple of minutes for questions if anyone is interested. Yeah. Thank you for your attention and time. Thank you.
Does anybody have any questions?
I mean, I'm curious. Does anyone think O'Hara's work is just sort of flippant, ridiculous? I mean, is this actually an insult to the elegiac form, or is there a certain a power here that shines through in the moments I perhaps semi-hysterically identify and celebrate?
I confess to being totally unfamiliar with that.
Ah.
So this has been a revelation.
Oh, great.
So this will send me to a book.
Good. That's terrific. I mean, I should add, you know, it's easy to talk about. These poems are so joyful. It's easy to talk about them, and it's also, in a sense, dangerous not to stop there when you're reading O'Hara, especially O'Hara's later work, the great odes, for example, to Bill Berkson, who recently passed, in fact. The incredibly abstract long poems of O'Hara's, like Second Avenue Biotherm, bear no relation to these extremely seductive short lyrics that I've been reading. So O'Hara is a very various poet. These poems are such a good way in, though. They're so fun. But, yeah, sorry.
I'm just wondering how far the idea of personification traveled.
Of personism? It traveled too far. It traveled too far because it's too easy. It's funny because O'Hara is identified as one of the main first-generation New York School poets, which, of course, proposes that there are other subsequent generations, second-generation, third-generation New York School poets. And it became practically a nervous tick in the New York poetry community, especially in the 1960s and early 1970s, to do the O'Hara, right? So you have poets like Ted Berrigan, Jim Brody, Ann Waldman, all of them producing as if out of one of those meat grinders, you know. I went to Jam Spa and got myself malted, and then I went over to Larry's and smoked some pot. So that's the big difference, where O'Hara and James Schuyler and Ashbery have Concord grapes on very fine cheese and have veal with, you know, vermouth poured all over it. The second generation smokes pot and has a cheese, you know, and has frozen supper, right? But it's still the same idea. I do this, I do that. I went there, I saw her, I saw him, we did this. And so it becomes, in a sense, a far too easy recyclable mode. This isn't to say that poets like Ted Berrigan aren't brilliant in their own way, but it casts a spell over subsequent generations of poets who I think didn't necessarily advance on O'Hara's work. And I say that particularly because I think O'Hara was able to get, you know, I don't know if this is particularly articulate, but get at levels of deep emotion that were agitating, in a sense, just underneath what appeared to be an almost gleefully banal surface, right? Like Puerto Ricans are not even humans, and they're just there to make his day warm, right? The signpost of Times Square, or that wonderful line, "Neon and daylight is a great pleasure." I mean, it seems so seductive and so easy to do, and yet, of course, it's not. It's not easy to do, particularly when those lines are there to serve a deeper purpose, and that's where I think O'Hara's elegiac mode comes into play so wonderfully. I don't see other poets following that kind of model, able to get at that level of intimacy, of you know, again, emotional depth, to speak quite plainly, that O'Hara managed to do in such an elusively surface-oriented poem. Does that sort of answer your...
Yes. Yeah. One more thing about personism is that the idea seemed to be suggesting that he was communicating to one specific person, whereas he seems to be communicating to everyone.
Right. And that's what's so mysterious about, I guess, what we could call O'Hara's pronominal shifts, right? In something like Day Lady Died, with "and everyone and I stopped breathing." You know, how does that work? Has the poet become this kind of, again, shamanic figure in which he's able to channel the sorrow of the tribe through his own body, right? And I'm leaning against the John door. He's positioning himself in space and time, and everyone and I. I mean, it's a great Whitmanic moment, right? Whosoever opens, what's the opening to Leaves of Grass? Whosoever touches this book touches the man, right? So there is a deeply romantic element to O'Hara's poetry and poetics, but it's leavened by O'Hara's simultaneous suspicion of seriousness, if you say. He's totally embarrassed by poetry. Simultaneously, he realizes the poem is the best, it's perhaps the best way of getting through some of these very complicated ideas about being in New York in the 1950s, being in the midst of this ferment of artistic activity, and also having this huge heart. Yeah.